So there's a question that I would like to explore in the talk this afternoon. And the question is, do conditions need to change in order for me to feel a sense of deep peace? Do the conditions need to change for you to feel deep peace in yourself? And I think this is really the question that equanimity asks us. Because usually we're so engaged in, the ego activity is so engaged in trying to change conditions in order to feel better, so that we can feel better. The old teaching that we've heard so many times of trying to find happiness outside of ourselves, where the deep contentment lives inside of us. But I think that we really need to ask the question to continue that exploration, do the conditions need to change? Outer conditions in our life, and to a certain extent, even the inner conditions of our body and our mind, do they need to change? Or is peace something different altogether from the conditions of our life and our mind and our body? I think this really points to the wisdom teachings of the Buddha. Because what one of the fundamental teachings is the teaching of anicca, or the impermanent nature of things. And when we really deeply understand this particular teaching, which is a fundamental teaching, we've all, if you've been exposed to Buddhist teachings, you've heard about the teaching of impermanence, that things are constantly changing and change, and everything is transient. And every moment arises a different experience, a different condition. And when we start to feel this and know this, then we get a sense that we don't actually have to change anything because everything's changing already. But our task, our invitation is just to get out of the way and allow the changing nature to express itself, to reveal itself. One time when I was on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, I call him my heart teacher. He's my heart teacher. He's my first teacher that I sat with many, many years ago, and I consider him the teacher who really awakened my heart, who touched my heart for the first time. And one time I was on retreat with Joseph, he has these lovely ways of kind of leading us on to something, and he said, I have a secret mantra for you. Secret mantra. This is a really important mantra, and it can really make a difference in your life. Very secret, but I'm going to reveal the secret to you. And we're all kind of going, yeah, you know, Joseph's going to give us a secret teaching, you know. And Joseph is from a Jewish background, and so in his kind of Yiddish lineage, he says, this is the secret teaching, he says, if it's not one thing, it's another. If it's not one thing, it's another. And that mantra has become a very significant mantra for me. Because each time I hope the conditions in my life settle down or change or shift, I remember, if it's not one thing, it's another. The next thing's going to arise. The next thing's going to happen. And there really isn't any escape. There's no way out. I think in my very, very first weekend retreat, which is the first retreat that I sat, a residential retreat, it was very, very hard for me. It's the first time I really sat with myself and was quiet with myself and looked at my own mind, and I was feeling like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. Being that intimate with myself, I didn't want to be that intimate with myself. And I was trying to find a way to get away. How do I get away? How do I get away from myself, from my experience? I don't want to sit here and feel my breath and, you know, look at my own mind. It's like, no, I don't want to be here. But yet, obviously I did, because I wouldn't have stayed at the retreat. It was only Friday night, Saturday, and then we left on Sunday, so it was short. I think it was probably Saturday afternoon, after about 24 hours, I really just needed to get out. I needed to get out of there. And so one of the memories I have from being in school, in elementary school, is that one of the ways to get out of class was to go to the bathroom, right? You could just go to the bathroom for a little while, hang out in the bathroom, and you could get out of class. And so I remembered this on my first retreat. I thought, this is the way out. I'll just go into the bathroom. It's a very interesting kind of way of thinking about it, thinking that that was going to give me some kind of refuge. So I went into the bathroom, and I'm standing in the bathroom, you know, standing there going, oh, I got away. And then there was this revelation, but I'm still here. My mind, my body, my experience, I didn't get away from anything. And in fact, I can't get away. My experience is unavoidable. And actually, that was my very first insight. And it was a revelation, but it was also very scary. There was no way out. No way out. So the conditions, there's no way out of the conditions. There's no way out of the conditions of this conventional world, of the thinking mind, of the body, the physical body, the birth, the aging, the sickness, the death, the whole relentless movement of this conventional world of time, of space. This is what we live in. This is the reality in which we live. And so the equanimity teachings are asking us, well, do these conditions need to change? Is that what we're trying to do? Are we actually trying to change the conditions in order to find peace? Because I think that's where the rational mind goes. Somehow the rational mind, the linear mind, the ego mind, which is the ego mind, it thinks, well, peace has to do with the stopping of conditions. And sometimes we can imagine that that's what we're trying to do in our meditation practices. We're trying to stop the conditions, so therefore we stop our minds. You know, you stop the thinking mind, you stop experiencing the sensations in the body, you go into these kind of absorption states, and that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to get to. And that is a certain path. It's a certain jhanic path. It's a certain samadhi path. And we can go into deep states of concentration where we do sort of, we have a sense of being beyond conventional conditions. It doesn't mean that we're beyond conditions, because there's still the condition of the concentration and the absorption, and that has its own experience. We're still in conditions. It's just that we're not really in contact with the sort of the grossness of conventional life. And so we can feel easily like, well, that's nice, I'll just escape there. You know, I'll just go there. But there are many, many stories of the, you know, people who have gone into deep states of concentration, and then they've come back and it's all here again. Life is here. Relationships, you know, work, or, you know, whatever it is, if we're our daily life, conventional life, it's here. And it's not so easy sometimes, unless we're actually working with that particular integration with our meditation, to make that adjustment from the deep states of concentration and absorption back into daily life. So much of the emphasis now, particularly at Spirit Rock where I teach, is very much on this integration of the mindfulness, of the awareness in life. In our life. Not that we have to go anywhere, not that we have to get out, but how do we be here, right in the midst of everything, and feel very deep peace and contentment. So this is, I think, is really what equanimity, this practice of equanimity asks us. This question, which is, you know, not that we have to have an answer for the question, but I think it's an interesting question to ask ourselves, because the tendency will be to try to change the conditions. And this is really like being on a treadmill. You know, the hamster wheel, the hamster on the wheel would just go round and round and round and round and round, trying to get off that wheel, the wheel of conditions. But things are always changing. They're always changing. This is one of my favorite stories from the teachings. It's actually from the Lankavatara Sutta, which I think it might be Hindu. That's the wrong one. This is a folklore. I'll tell you that one later, the Lankavatara Sutta. So this is a folklore story. A man named Sei Wang owned a beautiful mare which was praised far and wide. One day this beautiful horse disappeared. The people of his village offered sympathy to Sei Wang for his great misfortune. Sei Wang simply said, "That's the way it is." A few days later, the lost mare returned, followed by a beautiful wild stallion. The village congratulated Sei Wang for his good fortune. He said, "That's the way it is." Sometime later, Sei Wang's only son, while riding that stallion, fell off and broke his leg. The village people once again expressed their sympathy at Sei Wang's misfortune. Sei Wang said, "That's the way it is." Soon thereafter, war broke out, and all the young men of the village, except Sei Wang's lame son, were drafted and were killed in the battle. The village people were amazed at Sei Wang's good fortune. His son was the only young man left alive in the village. But Sei Wang's kept his same attitude. Despite all the turmoil, gains and losses, he gave the same reply, "That's the way it is." I call this the fortunate, unfortunate story. And I, having heard this story early on in my practice, I'm always aware of this turning of events. Something that seems so unfortunate becomes fortunate. Or something that seems so fortunate becomes very unfortunate. And if my mind lands or my mind fixes in any position, I see that, that shifts, it changes. In fact, that wheel just keeps turning, and it has two sides. Nothing is either fortunate or unfortunate in its essence. But things keep changing. Things keep shifting. And when I'm able to stay open to this wisdom, to this revelation, it allows me to be in less resistance, to be in less struggle with the way things are. It's easier to let go. It's easier to be in the flow, so to speak. And this is the wisdom that starts to shine through as we look more deeply into our experience. It's one of the key investigations or the key inquiries we do when we do mindfulness practice or insight practice. In retreat, we're really often invited to look at that, the impermanent nature of all phenomenon. Moment to moment, the changing nature of thoughts and feelings and sensations and sounds, changing moment to moment to moment to moment, moods and mind states, this flux, this flow. And the more that we do that, we see that we're not only looking outside, but our inner experience is just this flow, this movement. So we see that deeply it's hard to hold on. It's hard to grasp. Because that grasping, it becomes quite apparent that we're trying to hold on to something that is always changing, that is always shifting. And it's only the mind that lands. It's only this mind that wants to fix, that wants to hold, that wants to grasp. But in nature, nothing can be held. Nothing can be held onto. Nothing can be grasped. And that's what we find. We find ourselves continually disappointed because we can't keep things the way we want them to be. We never know from one moment to the next what's going to happen. And in our deepest part of our being, we know this is true. And we want to defend against it. We want to block it. We want to push it away, thinking we can control reality. And that's where the ego comes in, this sense of self comes in, thinking it can and it tries so hard, and it's just foibled again and again and again. So sense of frustration and disappointment and anxiety. It's much more apparent when you're when we're in a place like India. In the West, our systems are pretty efficient. Things run pretty well here, given the nature of change. But when you're in a country like India, you see that it's really man-made. The things don't run quite as well as they do here, and there's always a sense of not knowing. I think there's this joke about one Indian train that that came on time. Everybody was celebrating that it actually came on time. But the reality was it was actually exactly 24 hours late. To the minute. So it's like you'd never know from moment to moment. It's just the systems aren't holding together as well. So we can live a little bit more in the delusion of control or the illusion of control that we've got things handled, but we don't. We don't. So this sense of disappointment and frustration and anxiety and fear that we feel, it's because of the uncontrollability. We know the uncontrollability. And it, when we really open to it and acknowledge it, there's a way we feel very vulnerable. We feel very fragile in the face of this immense reality, this immense truth. And so much of the ego activity is formed to try to defend against this vulnerability, to actually manifest in such a way that we feel strong and empowered and we're on top of things and we've got it together. Because if we actually are honest with ourselves, there's a real tenderness, there's a real fragility there. And then through the meditation and through the practices, we start to open, we start to come into contact with reality, with the way things are, not just outwardly, but inwardly, in the physical level, the level of our body, the level of our mind, that our bodies are deteriorating, that from the minute we are born, it's all downhill from there. You know, it's just, we're just moving right towards decay. We're moving right towards death. You know, we know that, but we don't want to really let it in. So this is the wisdom teachings are asking us to open to the truth, to see things as they are, to see things clearly. And so when we do equanimity practice, that's what we're doing, saying things are as they are. May I accept things the way they are. May I accept things with grace. May I accept things with care. May I let go of my struggle. And the struggle is the resistance to this reality, this nature of reality that is immense, that is boundless, that is mysterious, that is changing, that is unsubstantial. We can't hold on to it. And that's both the bad news, but it's the good news. It's the good news, because the more that we come into recognition of that, the more we let go, and we are the flow. We are the expression of that openness. We are the expression of that mystery. And we feel that and live it and experience it and feel the effects of it in our life. So we're letting in more and more. As we let go, as we open, we're letting in the truth of things, to see things clearly, see things as they are. Jack Kornfield, I said something to Jack one day, and he just kind of made this quip. He said, "Yes, the winds of karma can change like the swish of a horse's tail." The winds of karma can change like the swish of a horse's tail. I love that. You know, it's just this, you can just feel and sense this swish. You know, just how quickly things can change. Going in one direction and then they go in another direction. Oh, we never know. We've all had these experiences. So do the conditions need to change in order for us to feel this deep peace? I think the teachings are pointing us beyond the conditions, but not separating us from the conditions. We think somehow we have to separate. It's just the dualistic mind that thinks that, the mind that polarizes, the mind that says it's black or it's white, it's this or it's that. But the teachings point to going beyond the duality, beyond the polarization, where perhaps both can exist, the conditions and being beyond the conditions at the same time. Doesn't have to be one way or the other way, but perhaps the whole life is expressing this peace, this stillness, this simplicity, this openness, this spaciousness, as the conditions arise and pass and arise and pass. I was teaching at the Insight Meditation Society this fall, part of the 3-month retreat that happens there. I think we just did our 30th year, the 30th year of the 3-month retreat there. And Joseph was teaching also, and he said that he had been teaching every one of those 30 years. I think he only missed one in 30 years. Just remarkable commitment, you know, remarkable generosity of his spirit to teach the 3-month retreats for people. And there were some really remarkable people there who were dealing with very, very difficult conditions, sitting for 3 months. There was one man who I was working with, a German man, who wanted to come to the 3-month retreat the year before. And he had been in India before that retreat, a year before. And he was on a motorcycle in India, which is already putting your life a little bit at risk. And a car crashed into him. And he was sent to the hospital, and he was all torn up in his body. And he was flown home back to Germany, and he was in the hospital for nine months. And he wasn't able to move. He was fairly paralyzed. He was bandaged up. That was his retreat, he says. He said, I thought I was going to the 3-month retreat, but I wound up being in that retreat setting instead. And he got to the point where he could start to work with his body and to move his body enough that he'd made it to last year's 3-month retreat. And he was walking around with a cane, walking very, very slowly. And he was remarkable. In his mind, in his being, he was so happy. He was so happy and bright and radiant because he was alive, because he was walking, because he was at the 3-month retreat, he was listening to the Dharma, he was hearing the teachings, and he was radiant. So here was a being, here was a person who had just spent this 9 months in a lot of trauma, a lot of, you know, unexpected trauma, and couldn't walk that way, was really experiencing still quite a lot of pain. So sitting in meditation with pain, but yet he was radiant. He was, you know, I kept checking in with him and kept checking in with him. And what he was in contact was with was the joy. The joy was what was strong. The happiness, the appreciation, the gratitude for his condition. And I find that to be very, very inspiring because, you know, I suppose it depends what you compare it to, isn't it? You know, we take our situations for granted pretty much, and then something happens, and then things turn on their heads, and then it's all different. But yet, here is an example of somebody who did not fall into distress. He did not fall into deeper states of suffering, which could have been. That could have been a direction that it could have gone, but it didn't. For some reason, his particular karmic condition was that it actually brought about more opening and more, I would say, more enlightened energy, more enlightenment. And it was just really, really inspiring for me to see that in a kind of an affirmation of this question, do conditions need to change in order for us to find deep peace? There was another woman there who was had MS, and she had it for about 4 years, I think. 4 years it had been coming on. And she was really having a very hard time walking and taking care of herself and managing the functions through the day. And it was very, very painful for her to sit with the realization of her deterioration. And they were crying in tears, and it was very painful. But one day she came in, and she really, something shifted, something really, she really got something. And she said, and I wrote this down, she said, you know, she said, I've had this very deep realization, I've had this very deep insight. She said, for 4 years I've wanted my body to be well. But does my body need to be well for me to be well? Does my body need to be well for me to be well? She says, I want so much more than that. Not just my body. She started giving all this energy to healing my body, but I realize now I want more than that. All this effort to attending my body, but what I want is to open my heart. I want to open my heart. And so she was realizing that that was a different path than the one that she had been taking. Because opening her heart, she could do no matter what condition her body was in. And so there was a shift for her. There was a realization for her that she could start to put her attention and her focus in another direction. Start to pay more attention to the quality of her mind, to her reactions, to her responses, just as we've been doing over these last 2 days together. Paying attention to the quality of our mind. How are we relating to what's happening? Because what's happening is what's happening. No matter how much I would wish things to be otherwise, things are as they are. Things are, as much as I want to resist that and fight that and struggle against that, things are as they are. And as soon as I'm able, and this is what we've been exploring this weekend, as soon as I'm able to drop into that acceptance, to that allowing, this is what ignites the opening of the heart. This is what allows for the resources of my being to come through, because I'm not caught in that contracted struggle anymore. I'm not frozen in the fixations of my own ideation, my own imaginations, my own fantasies, my own ideas about what I want, which is what the Buddha was pointing to, the I want, the tanha. That's tanha in Pali, the tanha, the cause of suffering, the I want. So we drop into the reality of the way things are. Breathe and let go. There's the opening. There's the opening right there. And with that opening comes forth the possibility of the wisdom, of the compassion, of the love, of the joy. Because I've let go. And as soon as I let go, everything's there. Everything's there. It may not all be there right in that beginning moment, but it starts to emerge. The qualities, the essential qualities of our being, of our heart, they're there. I'm thinking of this Tibetan story that says that this old Tibetan couple who lived in poverty and lack, but underneath their hut was a treasure grove of jewels and diamonds and gems. But the old couple never asked if they were there, and the jewels never revealed that they were there. And yet they were always there. The jewels are always there, just waiting to be discovered, waiting to be uncovered. And so our path is the path of letting go. In the simplest terms, we talk about the path of letting go, or the path of renunciation, the path of this release, the releasing. And what we're releasing is the ego activity. And we could say the ego activity is the hope and the fear. The hope and the fear, the attachment and the resistance. Attachment and resistance. So that's what we've been working with. We've been turning the attention this weekend to the actual manifestation in the immediate moment reality of that experience of attachment and aversion, and how that actually manifests in our mind. Mind and then body. Body follows mind. So when the mind fixes, our body gets contracted. When our body loosens, our mind loosens. It's all one, no separation. So we work directly with our mind. And one of the ways we've been focusing, and one way that's really workable and accessible for us, is working with that particular negative charge of judgment. Judgment in the negative sense. This, I'm wrong, it's wrong, it shouldn't be happening like this, I really shouldn't be experiencing this, what's wrong with me? All this judgment that we pile on top of ourselves, which just feeds the resistance and the contraction and the pain and the suffering. That's an area that we can work with. We can begin to be aware and acknowledge and name, oh, there's the judgment. There's the judgment. And then we can follow that with, I don't want to follow that judgment. And that's the wisdom. That's the compassion that comes through. It says, no, I'm not going to follow that judgment, because that judgment is pulling me down. That judgment is painful. When I believe that, when I follow that, I just go down the wrong road. So the wisdom and the compassion come through the awareness of seeing that. We can work with that. That's kind of the outer layer there. I don't know if we can really transform until we work with the judgment. The judgment is so debilitating, and it so interferes with our movement of the heart that we can be completely imprisoned by it. And I think that if that is a strong pattern for you, I really encourage you to make that a priority in your practice, is to work with the judgment. Because it stops everything in its tracks. That's its job, in a way. Its job, the job of the judging mind, is to keep you the way you are. The ego mind wants you to stay the way you are. It thinks that you're going to be a lot better off if you stay the way you are. That's its job. And we can't fault it for doing its job. But there's something that is wiser, there's a more profound understanding that knows about the transformation that's possible for us, that can look that judge in the eye and say, yeah, I know you're doing your job, but it's not helpful right now. I'm moving on. I'm moving on. So we work with that. That's one form of the way the resistance takes hold, the ego activity takes hold. And that we can work with. We can feel it, we can sense it, we can know it, we can name it. The awareness practice, though, asks us to come into contact with our experience. So right at the beginning, the initial invitation is to pay attention. Pay attention. And we can see how hard that is. Just that initial invitation. Because if we pay attention, there are consequences. We start to see. We start to come into contact with who we are and how this ego is formed, and the ways that we act out and the ways that we do things that are hurtful, in the ways that we are actually in pain and suffering. And that means then we come in contact with the suffering. And for the most part, we'll do almost anything we can to avoid the suffering. So how can we be here? How can we fully be here and avoid the suffering at the same time? Doesn't go together. So if we're really making a commitment to being here, it means that we're also making a commitment to be with things the way they are, to be with life the way it is, and that is pain and pleasure arise and passes away, and that's unavoidable. It's unavoidable. So I think sometimes, you know, and I'm aware when I speak with people who are involved in the practice, you know, I think sometimes we can skirt what it is that we're truly making a commitment to. It can feel good to meditate and to do our practice, but we're really making a commitment. If we're true to ourselves, if we're honest with ourselves, to being free, to being liberated, to being released from our hopes and our fears, our resistance, to the conditions of this life, of this world, to be fully here, fully centered and grounded in the center of our life, the way it is. That's what I've made a commitment to. And that's what I know these teachings are inviting. They're radical. It's radical what's being asked of us. And we're being asked, and as the Buddha said, we're being asked because it's possible. The Buddha said, I wouldn't ask you to do this if I didn't think it was possible for you. And it's beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful expression of faith in humanity that we really can be free of our pain and our suffering. We really can be. And so the path is clear. The path is clear. And for me, the equanimity is a pointer right to the center of that, what's required, that radical acceptance of the way things are. Not as a way to then stop, because that's the way they are, so what difference does it make, you know? If that's the way they are, there's nothing I can do, so I may as well just check out. No, that's the way they are, so that then I can engage. Then I can truly be here because I'm no longer in my resistance. When I can truly be here, then I can really be here. And being here with, when the heart opens, with love and compassion and joy and all those beautiful qualities of our nature, we're all here. When I'm really here, then all of me is here. All of my essence is here. So we want to allow our experience as much as we possibly can, as much as we possibly can tolerate. And if we can't tolerate it, can we have compassion for ourselves? Because we've hit our limit at the moment. This is as much as I can open right now. This is as much as I can do right now. It's okay. It's really okay. And it's okay because that's the way it is. That's the reality. So this is as much as I can give you right now. This is as much as I can offer of myself right now. I wish I could give more. I wish there was more of me available, but there's not. I'm a limited human being. I'm not fully enlightened Buddha yet. Maybe at some point I will be. Then I can give all of myself to you, but I can't yet. And this is the compassion. This is the expression of compassion. Not only to myself, but to all those that I come into contact with. It's a beautiful expression of our true humanity. And I love this this quote from Hafiz, one of the Sufi poets, who says, "Don't surrender your loneliness too quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human and even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of God absolutely clear. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep." We don't often have invitations quite in that way. And he speaks about fermenting these human feelings, these human difficulties. They're food for our awakening. They're grist for the mill, as you've heard. They're manure for Bodhi.
No.
Manure for Bodhi. Bodhi is the Bodhi tree, the tree the Buddha sat under. Manure for the Bodhi. Let it work. Let it work in you. We don't have to let go too soon. We don't have to defend. We don't have to push these things away. We don't have to be enlightened yet. Especially since we're not. This is the invitation. To be where we are, to be who you are, to be as you are, because that's the truth. To be in truth with the way things are. So that's my offering to you this weekend. This invitation that has really been the one that I've received and is really settled in me. And I hope that there's a way that you can find this helpful as well. This way to settle. It's really about settling. Relaxing. Settling more in ourselves. Thank you.